I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, The Black Dancing Body as a Measure of Culture. From Elvis Presley to Benny Goodman, Eminem to modern ballet, African-American art forms have had an undeniable influence on European-American popular culture. This adoption of practices and traditions from one group of people by another is known as cultural appropriation. If one looks at the practice of cultural appropriation within the United States, both historically and currently, one can learn much about this country's racial struggles, as well as get a feel for American society at large. We are fortunate to have with us this evening Brenda Dixon Gottschild, a cultural historian, actress, and dancer. Dixon Gottschild has been at the forefront in examining the appropriation of African culture by European Americans, particularly within the medium of dance. The author of three books, Dixon Gottschild has received several awards, including the 2001 Congress on Research in Dance Award for Outstanding Scholarly Dance Publication, the 2004 De La Torre Bueno Prize for Scholarly Excellence in Dance Publication, and the Congress on Research in Dance Award for Outstanding Leadership in Dance Research. She is currently a professor emerita of dance at Temple University and a senior consultant and writer for Dance Magazine. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped, and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. A book signing will follow the presentation this evening. And now, please join me in welcoming Brenda Dixon Gottschild.
To two of my aesthetic ancestors, the two big B's for whom the year 2004 was their centennial celebration, and who are equals in greatness and in moving the American cultural climate from hot to cool. George Balanchine and William Count Basie. And also this evening, another pouring libation to the late, great Donny Hathaway. Today is his birthday. Ashe. I'm trying to get close. Make contact with your warmth body, your aura body, your infrared body, your Kirlian energy field body. Bodies. Bodies. Those lines are spoken to me by my husband, Helmut Gottschild, in a movement theater piece we created together titled Tongue, Smell, Color. In it, as an African-American woman and a German man, we explore issues of gender, nationality, guilt, memory, and race, sometimes zeroing in on the white male fixation and obsession with the black female body. In an episode in the piece called Touch, Skin, Memories, as Helmut approaches and pursues me, he says those words, I want to get close, make contact, and so on. I tell him he's trespassing, that those astral bodies that he's addressing are only a dancer's imagery. He takes offense and says that those bodies exist, are real, and can be sensed, and that we all have many bodies that are not static, but in constant flux. That statement sends me into a tailspin of memories. And as though I'm in a trance, I repeat that word, memories. 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 Until he cuts me off. Yes, memories. The body remembers. The body remembers. Indeed, the body speaks. The body tells us what is valued in the culture. Bodies are mirrors that absorb, remember, and reflect society's politics, art, religion, aesthetics, hopes, fears, strengths, failings. Both the officially sanctioned versions and the sub rosa closeted taboos. Bodies are barometers measuring the pulse of society, and I'm here today to celebrate the dancing body, the black dancing body, as a measure of culture that bridges divisions and blurs boundaries. I want to begin by just giving you a context. Now, I think everybody in this room probably knows that dance is as old as humankind, and that there are many kinds and forms of dance, and dance has served many functions in different societies and in different eras. For example, in African and African American cultures, and I use the term Africanist to embrace these two, so in Africanist cultures, dance is an integral part of religious practice, and the deities present themselves to the community through the dancing bodies of the religious devotee who dances when and as the spirit moves her. On the other hand, in most Christian sects, the dancing body is a no-no in religious practice and is regarded as the vehicle that leads to evil rather than enlightenment. That's one example of what it means for us to think about the dancing body as a measure of culture that points out what is valued or repressed in a given society. For the moment, let's also think about dance as an embodied language. As ballerina Alessandra Ferri said in a Dance Magazine article, and I quote, "You don't just use your body, but you go through your body to talk." But in a culture like ours that privileges words over movement and thus reinforces the dichotomy between mind and body, there's often a tension between the language of words and the language of movement. Often those people concerned with the language of words give short shrift to the language of movement. But the language of movement speaks to us as profoundly as words, although through different means and layers of experience. Now, we know that inside each verbal language there are dialects, jargons, colloquialisms, neologisms, and so on. How does a language, a verbal language, grow and change? Well, frequently by taking on elements of other languages. For example, I travel back and forth with my husband between the USA and Germany, and I find that I hear more and more American English in German speech. For example, their word for a cell phone is a handy. Well, the same thing happens in movement, too. Like the spoken word, dance comes in many languages. And they receive impulses and infusions from other languages. And a good example of this, and one of my focal points, is the borrowing, as Andrew referred to it, the borrowing of Africanisms in so-called white dance forms. And believe me, dance has been enriched by these imports, not corrupted. But that's where we enter the realm of the politics of dance and culture. Europeanist body languages and Africanist body languages have been speaking with one another ever since they first met and clashed about 5 centuries ago, but they are different languages. To illustrate this point, I'm going to quote something from my first book, The Digging the Africanist Presence. And I've pasted it in my very sloppy notes. This is pages 8 and 9. In traditional European dance aesthetics, The torso must be held upright for correct classic form. The erect spine is the center, the hierarchical ruler from which all movement is generated. It functions as a single unit. The straight, uninflected torso indicates elegance or royalty and acts as the absolute monarch, dominating the dancing body. This vertically aligned spine is the first principle of Europeanist dance, with arm and leg movements emanating from and returning to it. The ballet canon is organized around this center. In fact, this structural principle is a microcosm of the post-Renaissance colonialist worldview. Like the straight-centered spine of its dancing body, Europe posited itself as the center of the world, with everything else controlled by, coming back to, and defined by it. Africanist dance idioms show a democratic equality of body parts. The spine is just one of the many possible movement centers, and it rarely remains static. The Africanist dancing body is polycentric. One part of the body is played against another, and movements may simultaneously originate from more than one focal point, the head and the pelvis, for example. Where am I? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Right. It is also polyrhythmic, different body parts moving to two or more rhythms simultaneously, and it privileges flexible, bent leg postures that reaffirm contact with the earth, sometimes called a get-down stance. The component and auxiliary parts of the torso, shoulders, chest, rib cage, waist, pelvis, can be independently moved or articulated in different directions. As assessed by Africanist aesthetic criteria, the Europeanist dancing body is rigid, aloof, cold, and one-dimensional. By Europeanist standards, the Africanist dancing body is vulgar, comic, uncontrolled, undisciplined, and most of all, promiscuous. Clearly, there is a translation problem going on here. Nevertheless, and despite different lexicons, the reason for dancing is like the reason for dreaming. Through dance or dreams, we access thoughts, ideas, and metaphors that cannot be perceived in any other way. In fact, dance is a literature that is illegible in literal translation. Dance is dance and words are words. Dancers know this. And who am I in all this? I am a performing researcher researching performance. The body is my medium, and I recognize that the body, the dancing body, the black dancing body, thinks, speaks, writes its signature across world history, whether we know it or not and whether we recognize it or not. There's a language of the body and a language of the word, and I simply do not intend to let the word get the last word. The two are equal players, and please, you may laugh, you may respond, I like it. The two are equal players, just as Africanist, Europeanist, and other world cultures are equals, none better than the other, just different. Writing is my choreography for the page, a dance in black and white interpolated in the medium of hard copy. My vocation is as much dependent on intuitive and effective actions and processes as it is on critical and cognitive skills and products, because I'm both a thinking body and a feeling head. Dance has many layers to be uncovered in researching, and this is maybe why sometimes I feel like I'm a detective, sniffing out the clues and acting on hunches. And we talked yesterday about, or today, how do you, you know, research something, and a lot of it has to do with intuition and hunches. Like the somatic trail I blazed about Africanisms in the ballet choreography of George Balanchine. Sometimes The work can be like E.L. Doctorow's quip on writing novels. He said, quote, "It's like night driving. You see as far as your headlights will let you, but you can make the whole trip that way." And Buddhist writer Natalie Goldberg advises that you, quote, "write from your obsessions. They're going to run your life anyway, so why not harness them?" Well, I am an artist, writing about art, writing into history, two marginalized legacies that indeed are my obsession and my passion: dance itself and Africanisms in dance. As a cultural historian, I use a creolized approach to interrogate dance as history, biography, sociology, anthropology, philosophy, religion. Sometimes my library is a street corner or a subway car or a newspaper. Sometimes my database is found in a theater or a loft. Yet traditional archival resources form the bedrock of my performance to research way of working. In doing my job, I observe, listen, read, interpret, surmise, analyze, and compare, and too often find myself confronted by inequalities, if not injustices. In the first book, Digging the Africanist Presence, I started out by asking questions of American ballet that, like all ballet, was regarded as a classically European, read, white, art form. But I was picking up a different scent. George Balanchine, a Russian choreographer who emigrated to the USA in the 1930s, joined up with entrepreneur Lincoln Kirstein to form the Ballet Society in 1946, which in 1948 became the New York City Ballet. Balanchine has been credited with the Americanization of ballet. Well, if that's the case, I asked, what makes his ballets so specifically American? Well, you know, I began to sniff an Africanist trail. But in order to verify it, I had to step back and see what was behind the trees. What were the clues? Who were the players? And I went back to what was right in front of my nose, namely contemporary culture and lifestyle. And here are some of the evidences. This is just a really quick, broad look, and basically focuses on the kind of things that were going on during that crazy period of the cultural wars of the 80s and 90s. Okay, so for evidence of Africanist presences as the semiotics of fashion and popular culture. And each time I will ask, so what's the message? Anybody can identify the woman on the left? No? Cicely Tyson. Okay. And the woman on the right? Bo Derek! I heard that. Ms. Ten. Okay, so what's the message? And guess whose braids came first? Here we go with a cover from, and I don't know the name of the model, from Jet Magazine. And here is Bo Derek again on the cover of Playboy. The Jet Magazine cover predates the Playboy cover by 2 years. Interestingly here, Bo, of course, was in a sense the creation of John Derek, her husband, who created the whole concept of 10, etc. Well, what I have to say here is simply that John Derek was obviously doing his research. An L model with an overarched spine. And again, what's the message here? Interestingly enough, the beveled hairdo of the late 90s, which looks like braids taken out. And again, this kind of arch, this is such a different profile for high fashion. If you think about Audrey Hepburn or the models of the 50s and the 60s, when it was about the I can barely do it, about the pelvic bones being thrust forward and this under. So that was more the look that you were. And now, of course, not only is it booty culture because of all of the influences that have crept in, but also if you think about the stiletto heels that women are wearing, which also thrust you this way. So this, of course, is a curve more than anyone has. But I show this because, again, the way, and certainly, you know, the title of the book, The Black Dancing Body, is to debunk the idea that there is a black or a white dancing body, that that's basically misconstruing how bodies are. But what's interesting is this had been considered, an overarched back had been considered a black body posture. And I just thought, how interesting that a body carriage so popular in the contemporary high fashion and entertainment industry and unduly characterized as an Africanist posture has to be, as you know, corrected in the dance world, where people are always told, Jawale, Willa Jo Zola talks about it in The Black Dancing Body, she got so tired of people telling her to tuck her butt in. So that it's either a matter of a black posture being exaggerated or modified when it enters the white world. A Vanity Fair advertisement. Notice the African-inspired head and neck wear. Lollapalooza hair wrapping. Another example of how white youth culture so readily adopts Africanisms as its own. No questions, no problems. White athletes hand jiving. How often in the 80s and 90s, we would see high fives, low fives, buttocks bumping, and other Africanist-inspired expressive movements in professional sports. Everybody knows the guy on the left, I'm sure. And how about the guy on the right? Anybody? Who said that? All right, she knows. Okay, but you knew that it was Jackie Wilson, Margaret. Okay, all right. Because, again, right. But, again, Jackie Wilson being one, and this is a photo that was given back to Jackie by Elvis. Jackie, you've got a friend forever. But this is just one of the role models that Elvis used in terms of not only his look, but, of course, his sound. What's the message here? What's the message? What's the message here? Baggies on the street. The oversized overalls of prison inmates, most of whom we know are black, first were picked up by their brothers and cousins in African-American neighborhoods, then by white youth, and then by the burgeoning hip-hop generation. At the top is a very young Criss Cross wearing their clothes both baggy and backwards, and also picked up by the high fashion industry before women were wearing everything so tight. There was, you remember the whole thing of women wearing, everything was falling off your shoulders? Right, okay. The high fashion industry, comme des garçons. Well, in a sense, when you think about the origin of a style like this all the way back to black prison inmates who were given clothes that didn't fit them in order to humiliate them. But again, what Arnold Haskell, a dance critic in the 1930s, said about African-American culture, taking nothing and creating beauty from it. If you trace back this history, then in a sense we can see all of these things as unconscious homage to black men in prison. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, so since we're talking about language, just look at how much African-American signifying has affected our speech and consequently our way of seeing the world. We all know that in hip talk, if I say, ooh, that's bad, what do I mean? That's good, it's fabulous, it's great. And when I say that's cool, it doesn't mean that I need my jacket. And if I go, ow, you know that I am not in pain. Rather than the class, rather than the classical Europeanist linear logic of cause, effect, and resolution, we have irony, paradox, and double entendre, indeed radical juxtapositions, as basic premises of the Africanist aesthetic. And where do we find them? In our postmodern lifestyles. Elsewhere in Digging the Africanist Presence, I discuss subtle Africanist resonances in other areas that have been considered exclusively white terrain. For example, to illustrate the widespread, though unconscious, cultural adoption of deep structure Africanist attitudes, mind you, I'm saying attitudes, not content, I discuss a dance genre known as contact improvisation. Contactors invent movement by supporting each other's weight in a vocabulary of rolling, suspending, lurching, balancing, and falling. They seldom work on proscenium stages, but rather in lofts and site-specific venues. They improvise frequently without music and generally perform in workout clothes. Like African-American movements as diverse as the early blues, jazz, and civil rights grassroots communities, the contact community began as a subculture that thrived in spite of establishment modern dance. And that's what I mean about attitude as opposed to content. In an example of perhaps inadvertent borrowing, even the contact improvisers jam, and lots of these jams happened again in the 80s, 90s, takes its name from, anybody know where jam comes from? Exactly, thank you. The jazz musician's word for group improvisation. Like an old-fashioned African-American revival meeting, these jams see contactors from far and wide converge to hold a marathon. And in contact, as in its jazz paradigm, participants improvise, allowing their creations to be inflected and modified by what the others are doing. And what's the message here? Anybody know who this person is? Dance people. Steve Paxton, right. Who could be called the father of contact improvisation. What's the precedent for wearing sunglasses while performing in a dark interior space? You know it. Jazz, right. And this, again, goes back to the bop era of the 1940s and 50s when after the big jazz, the hot, it was a change from hot jazz to cool, from the big bands of Louis Armstrong, Jimmy Lunsford, Duke Ellington, which played out to the audience and sent everything to you, even Duke Ellington playing the piano and looking out, to people like Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, who played in to each other wearing bob caps, sunglasses, even in dark places, and it was for the audience to come to them. That's a good example of the difference between hot and cool media. So what I'm saying then about contact is these subtextual influences. In other words, without the jazz aesthetic, contact couldn't have come about. The Africanist presence was such a driving force in the foundations of modern dance that its pervasiveness may partly account for its neglect. So there we are. And again, sometimes I have said that I am the, how did I put it? Oh, I'm the culture, I'm the patchwork quilt maker of cultural theory. Because as you can see, like the pictures of Bo Derek, the pictures of Elvis came from Ebony magazine. These pictures are from Louis Horst's book, Modern Dance Forms. So you see, this information has been out there for a long time. It's just about putting it together in order to relate to what we know now in our current era. So, from Louis Horst's book. On the left is a sculpture from Gabon Picasso's Grande Danseuse and Martha Graham in Primitive Canticles in 1935. Graham again in Satiric Festival, also 1935. A dance with a pose like this would have been called archaic in form, which you have to look upon as a euphemism for Africanist. And if you will see, she is indeed disrupting the idealized European dancing body that I slightly described and showed you before. The vertical line is broken by her arched back. Instead of the body being turned out, her feet are parallel, and indeed, instead of the rounded port de bras of ballet, she has angular arms. Looking very much like African sculpture, indeed, as does Iris Mabry in a dance called Birdspell. And just to say a little something about the nexus between modern dance and modern art. So people like Graham, Mabry, other modern dancers of that period, the 30s, 40s, 50s, were not necessarily going up to Harlem and boogieing, but their connection with these Africanist poses had to do with the African art of people like Picasso, Braque, and Matisse. Okay, so what about these Africanist references in ballet? And I've talked about it a little bit, but just a little bit more. Pelvic and chest, articulation and displacement instead of vertical alignment, leg kicks instead of measured battements, angular arms instead of the fluid, rounded port de bras of traditional classical European ballet, are indeed Africanist references in ballets choreographed by Balanchine that stretch from Apollo, that he choreographed in 1928, through dances that he made in the 1970s. But even more significant than these motifs is, the subtext, the underlying speed, vitality, energy, coolness, the deep structure of a jazz aesthetic that made all the difference in giving ballet an American quality. But naming and language are of utmost importance. These qualities are not only American, they are African-American. Of course, many other choreographers have subsequently followed suit, and we barely notice that the works we label as ballet or modern are hyphenated forms, Euro-Afro-American forms. You know, we need to pay closer attention to the language of words that we select to describe the language of movement. Whoops. Okay. Anybody recognize the guy on the right? Yes. And anybody recognize the lady on the lower left? Catherine Dunham. Catherine Dunham, yes. And just a little bit about this. This is Balanchine with Dunham in the people, some of the principals from The Cabin in the Sky that was choreographed in 1940. Balanchine and Dunham co-choreographed this. What's really interesting is for us to understand that before there was a New York City ballet, Balanchine cut his eye teeth on Broadway, choreographing musicals in the genre and style that was totally infused by an Africanist aesthetic. He choreographed I Married an Angel, On Your Toes, The Boys from Syracuse. He worked with the Nicholas Brothers. He worked with Josephine Baker. So in other words, he was infused in becoming an American with the African-American aesthetic, which in his brilliant way he would ultimately use in his ballets. Here he is, this is from Dance Magazine, with ballerina Violette Verdi, showing her some jazz. And why I say this is because Balanchine's body is clearly the Africanist, the jazz aesthetic body. Why am I saying this? His hips are off-center, his legs are turned in, the arms are angular, the face is cool. He is both hot and cool simultaneously. Verdi, behind him, is in the position that she has internalized as correct. Here's Balanchine with, anybody know the guy on the left? Arthur Mitchell, who was the first African-American in a major ballet company, hired by Balanchine in the late 60s. Left in 1969, after, I think, somehow, sometime after the Four Little Girls were bombed in Birmingham, and he was driven to start his own black ballet dance company, Dance Theater of Harlem. So in this one, it looks as though Mitchell maybe is showing Balanchine some jazz. Now, why would I say this? Anybody just yell it out. What do you see in body language there? Say it. Hip. Who said that? Whoever said it was right. Good. Okay. It's the hip again. And again, Balanchine is a choreographer. He's teaching Mitchell some movement. Mitchell has translated the movement into a much deeper get-down pose than what Balanchine has. And what's interesting is it's this kind of transformation that a choreographer will, a transformation by a dancer, that a choreographer will then often use in his choreography. Stealing? No. Appropriation? Yes. And according to Mitchell, Balanchine described his ideal ballerina as possessing a short torso, long arms, and long legs, a designation that fit to a T the censured profile of the black dancing body. And here you have it, in my own dancing body. The waist is up here, by the way. By stating this preference and following it through with his artistic choices, Balanchine subtly and perhaps unconsciously shifted the balance of the ideal ballet body toward the black side. And just to show you what I mean, does anybody recognize this beautiful ballerina? Montaigne. It's Margot Fonteyn. Royal Ballet, European classical ballet, in which the modest tutu'd body emphasizes the torso length. Oh, I can do it with this thing. Emphasizes the torso length and shortens the legs, whereas... Just an ad from a dance magazine. And again, this American ballerina, all arms and legs. Okay, so beyond the Balanchine example, and in a larger sense, my work aims to break down barriers between so-called art and so-called entertainment. Between high and low, between black and white, if you will. Indeed, my work is concerned with dance, with research, and with affecting social change. That final area is the one that centers and grounds my thinking, professionally and personally. I aim to perform corrective surgery on the historical record. Quoting Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, the woman who wrote Reviving Ophelia, she refused to get an award from the American Psychological Association a couple of years ago because the APA was involved in interrogating people in Guantanamo, and it almost split the organization apart. And Dr. Pfeiffer would not accept her award that year. And she said, I loved it, the duty of the writer is to help other people's moral imagination grow. In my next book, titled Waltzing in the Dark, I discuss the career of Margot Webb and Harold Norton. Whoops, Okay. A black dancing couple that modeled itself after white dance forms, demonstrating that cultural exchange is a two-way street. But the difference is that, like blacks doing ballet, their embracing of white forms was unwelcomed and demeaned in white American venues. In fact, they were treated as trespassers. Harold Norton and Margot Webb's career serves as the barometer of the times and is our tour guide on this excursion through African-American vaudeville, swing-era lifestyles, and pre-civil rights-era discrimination. Webb's solo specialty, I hope you can see, she's on point, was a ballet-inspired jazz number done on point using the ballet vocabulary of bourrées and fast genet and pirouette turns. In a sense, this team, I call them ballet dancers manqué, okay? Because if they had had the opportunity, that was what they would have done. Norton's solo was a spear dance, but do not be misled, not in an African style, but in the pseudo-ethnic style of Ted Chaun's modern dance ethos of the era. So there was no torso articulation in this, but instead it was these kinds of things showing the, you know, and leaps, showing the warrior's prowess. Like their peers, they performed in segregated cotton club type venues, meaning all black entertainment for exclusively white audiences. So there were cotton clubs all across America. And these were from Margot's private collection. She had underlined that in her rage. She was a very bitter woman, with good reason. Not a black and tan, strictly for white people. There were some black and tan clubs. And did any of you ever read the autobiography of Malcolm X? Okay, because you know he talks about the black and tan clubs in Boston. And of course, Malcolm was an incredible Lindy Hopper, okay, early on. That was the movie that Denzel Washington should have gotten the Oscar for. This is my little... Anyway, so yeah, in Philadelphia, everywhere. In the book, that's the second book, I talk in detail about the issues of them traveling and how what I call the racial etiquette of America could change from town to town, not even mentioning state to state. And this is just a beautiful, their favorite number was a waltz interpretation. And again, ballet-trained dancers, because of the stereotypes, they were not fast tap dancers or whatever. They really, there was no hope for them in white vaudeville. But they were revered in black vaudeville because they had this romantic image, which, of course, you know, black dancers weren't supposed to have. And I love this. He's bringing her down from a lift. And, well, he, better than I, is in a very perfect little first position as he brings her down. Oh, okay. This is, okay. I'm going to leave this. Okay. So, like their peers, also their career was defined and delimited by a racial etiquette that kept the lid on African-American achievement. In other words, what was happening in African-American vaudeville was a microcosm of what was happening in American society. Again, the dancing body as a measure of culture. You know, I don't think people realize how much of what we consider modernist depended on the Africanist quotient. You saw a little bit of that in the positions of Martha Graham and the other dancers. Did you know also that the exquisite trumpet artistry of Louis Armstrong actually changed the tenor, if you will, of the trumpet playing in European orchestral music? In 1919, conductor Ernst Ansermé predicted that African-American music would be the highway the whole world will swing along tomorrow. And how right he was. And today's celebrant, Count Basie, belongs right up there in the same key, in the same breath. How many people realize that George Balanchine's famous ballet, The Four Temperaments, is infused with Lindy Hop references, which I describe in detail in the first book. So, to spotlight these achievements, I conclude Waltzing in the Dark with a chapter titled Legacy that examines the jazz aesthetic as a basic integer in the modernist equation. And there I discuss the profound influence of the Lindy Hop and swing music on affecting social cultural changes in the USA and in Europe. My most recent book, and I'm winding down, it should be about just 5 more minutes at most. My most recent book is titled The Black Dancing Body, A Geography from Kuhn to Kuhl. It's a map of American history as told through the body, a map that predicates black history and dance history as central to the formation of American culture. It confirms and affirms the body itself and the fact that bodies speak a language we cannot ignore. My basic premise is that race and body types are not biological imperatives, but social constructs and cultural stereotypes, or conveniences, if you will, for the purpose of separation and categorization. I take a long, detailed look at the sometimes loved, sometimes hated attributes of black dancing bodies, with chapters named for and devoted to feet, buttocks, hair, skin color, and finally, soul and spirit, which I discuss as embodied, animate attributes, as American, African-American cultural components that belong to white people as much as Beethoven and ballet belong to black people. And I'm passing by this slide, and I just wanted to show you one image. Now, this image does not appear in the book, but I devote the opening of the buttocks chapter to this person. Does anybody know anything about her or what she was termed? Sarah Bartman, right, called facetiously the Hottentot Venus, okay? Paraded through 19th century Europe as an exotic oddity known as the Hottentot Venus, facetiously, of course, Sarah Bartman's body set the stage for the perception of the black female body to this very day in a contested love-hate relationship, as seen, for example, in the Europeanist adoption of the bustle. Her body can be understood as the battlefield where the war between white self and black other was waged. And you may have read several years ago, after almost 200 years, that body was returned to South Africa. So I interviewed 24 dance practitioners. Oh, and just one more thing to say about that image. Pointed out in an article called Images of Sarah Bartman. In 19th century British freak shows, white freaks were exhibited as oddities or exceptions, while blacks, like Bartman, were presented as typical of their race. The Bartman rendering you just saw has to then be understood as more a figment of the European imaginary than a reliable scientific social record. Okay, so just to end, Meredith Monk is a postmodern composer, vocalist, and choreographer who creates innovative movement, music, theater works. I interviewed 24 people for this black dancing body, black, white, brown, young, old, not so old, tap dance, hip-hop, ballet, modern, etc. At the end of my interview with Meredith Monk, I asked her if there was anything that she'd like to add, and here's what she said, and it's in the book. It's a long quote. "Well, my gratitude that somehow I've been allowed to have this African-American experience as part of my life and my culture. I start really becoming aware of it when I'm in Europe and Europeans are trying to rock and roll dance and it's kind of pathetic. And then you realize how much of America is black culture, that we've had the privilege of having this as part of what we've grown up with. I feel that so much when I'm away, out of America, and how actually the dominant culture has been the black culture on a certain level in terms of what's going out to the world. What people are getting from America is black culture. Even though I'm white, I feel like I have that in my body. I have that loose thing in my body. But then I have to say this with total gratitude and awareness. Not that I take this for granted. I take this with great gratitude." So now I'm working on another book, partially funded by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage through Dance Advance. I have titled it Joan Myers Brown and the Improbable Hope of the Black Ballerina, an American narrative. This is Joan Myers Brown. For any of you who've studied different ballet techniques, you can see that she is a Tchaikovsky-trained dancer and was trained by the great Anthony Tudor in Philadelphia in the 1940s. Okay, this is when she was about 19. In a professional career of 50-plus years, Myers Brown's vision and achievements have affected generations of dancers, teachers, and choreographers. Her personal and professional history reflect hardships as well as advances of African Americans in the artistic and social developments of the late 20th and into the 21st century. I argue that Myers Brown's Philadelphia School of Dance Arts and the Philadelphia Dance Company, known as Philadanko, maybe some of you have heard it or seen of it, are responsible for an approach to performance that can be called the Philadelphia School, comparable to the renowned Philly sound created by composers Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. I use Myers Brown's career as the fulcrum to leverage a discussion of the interplay between performance, cultural formation, and race politics, as demonstrated by the development of her dance community that burst beyond the parameters of Black Philadelphia and regional borders to reach national and international renown. So where does this take us, and where do I leave you? There's a Buddhist saying, "What the mind doesn't know, the eye cannot see." That may help explain white America's blind spot about its Africanist heritage. I continue to seek to open minds and acknowledge bodies in order to see, to really see what is, and to imagine, to dream the improbable hope of what might be. Ashe. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I hope that I see that people are having to leave. I appreciate your staying. If you can stay a little longer, I would love to maybe take 5-10 minutes for any questions, but I also would love to pull out my purple pen and sign some books. So, oh yeah, where is the bookstore representative? I see. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So, any questions, comments, thoughts, dilemmas? Yes. And if you would please identify yourself.
I'm Susanna. I'm the director of the Women's Center here at Dickinson. I just want to
thank you. I can't hear you.
I'm Susanna. I'm the director of the Women's Center here at Dickinson. I just want to thank you very much. It was a wonderful, fascinating talk for me. I'm very outside of the world of dance. And so I just really appreciated it, particularly because I'm very familiar with Toni Morrison's Playing in the Dark. So for me, it was a very complimentary experience, and so I just want to say thank you very much. It was really wonderful.
Thanks. And that Playing in the Dark was so key to me being able to develop these theories. Again, between Toni Morrison, Joanne Kaley Hinohimoku, who wrote a wonderful essay, an anthropologist looks at ballet as a form of ethnic dance, Robert Ferris Thompson, of course, African Art in Motion, and I would say what's his name? James Holloway, the one who did, the Africanisms in American Life. There was not much in dance that was going on to be able to help me along. And I also, was encountering the backwater of the dance establishment at that time. So it's interesting that you mentioned, thank God for Toni Morrison and Playing in the Dark. Yeah. Yes.
Hi.
Corinthia.
Yes.
Hi.
When I met you yesterday, we were speaking a little bit.
Can everyone hear?
Yeah. Mine? Okay.
So stand.
Okay. Yeah. We were speaking a bit yesterday about being post-racial and if that was achievable or not. Mm-hmm. I was just curious as to what you think, how dance can play a role in being post-racial, if there is going to be a continuing of these appropriations, as you call it, mm-hmm. without mm-hmm. giving credit to mm-hmm. its actual history and lineage. Do you think that that would disrupt the process of being post-racial, or would it help further it?
You know, I think we are going to have to get rid of that term, post-racial, you know. I think it's kind of becoming a... What would it be the equivalent of? I can't think right now on my feet, but it would be the equivalent of some term that we had in the 90s or the 80s or whatever to say, or colorblind, you know? It's kind of a consonant with something like that. And I don't, if we can think outside the box, if you will, if we could think outside of that category and then begin to conceive of what it is that we need to do face-to-face with each other, with one another, in terms of acknowledging what we know, or stopping somebody who is not acknowledging what we know, you know, making the choices, of course, of when to wage such a little battle. But, I mean, that stuff is not going to stop. I feel like, you know, that the whole thing of appropriation is human nature, you know. The whole thing of borrowing from other people is human nature. So that's not going to stop, and I don't necessarily see the history of inequality between whites and non-whites just, you know, reaching a point of cessation. It changes and it moves in different ways. More, if you think about the idea, and again, you know, I'm talking about in here that there is no such thing really of white and black, you know, whatever, that we those are constructs. You know, social constructs. And white simply means privilege at this point. White means the norm. And so Jews were not considered white, you know, up until about less than 50 years ago. Certainly there were times in America, Italians were not considered white, you know. Irish were not. The wonderful Noel Ignatieff book, How the Irish Became White. So white represents privilege, but it's so hard for us to understand that it's not simply a matter of skin color, because all of these groups now are considered white. So now we see them through that lens. When 100 years ago, people would look at an Irishman or somebody Italian, they did not look white. You know, you have to also think about the ways in which, I think we talked about this a little bit yesterday, the ways in which class, caste, and gender all factor in as well, you know. But the idea, what Ignatieff talks about in that lovely book, How the Irish Became White, is that there was a moment in time when, and it takes place in Philadelphia, in 1850s, when the blacks and Irish, and this was frequently the case, were vying for the same jobs. And unions were becoming, you know, extant, okay? And... he fantasizes for a moment in that what would have happened if the Irish did, and of course the whole idea politically of divide and conquer. So the powers that be, the white powers that be, were enticing the Irish in order to be able to establish a different kind of hegemony. So the idea that blacks and Irish could have banded together, you know, in a union movement or something in the middle of the 1850s, it's like our world would be different, you know. So anyway, just this idea of borrowing, but also the idea of what, you know, what white means. And it's so hard for us to kind of unravel all of the mythology that we have around that. I recommend that book by Ignatieff, How the Irish Became White. And there's another book from a film studies auteur perspective. It's by Richard Dyer, and I love it. The cover is totally white, and the book is just called White. And it's Richard, D-Y-E-R, and he talks about all the ways in which we have been, you know, from a film, you know, historian's, a cultural film historian's perspective, how we've been programmed to vie for that and to opt for that, okay? Margaret.
Hi. Hi. Hello, I'm Margaret Morrison. I'm a tap dancer.
Ah, okay.
I kind of have a complex question, but I really appreciated in the Black Dancing Body that at one point you spoke of the blackening of American culture. I really enjoyed that term because it felt very empowering, and I enjoyed your talk today, very empowering. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm speaking from a problem I feel like I have in my own community, my tap dance community. Yeah. When we bring up the word appropriation, people react very strongly. Uh-huh. And I feel like what happens is it sets up the immediately feeling that we're talking about theft and abuse. And with a fence down the middle, with one community being the abuser and the thief and the other community being the abused. And as a tap dancer, I'm trying very hard to start the conversation within my community to talk about race, to talk about gender. I don't know if you... It's not really a question. It's just it's kind of a problem now. I feel like we have a linguistic problem of how to move into the conversation without everyone bristling at the words.
Right. Anna. Yeah, I was just thinking, I had a conversation with Anna and Carrie, I think, earlier today, and the whole issue then also about how to talk about some of these things, how to, as a non-black person, how to approach it without not only hurting somebody's feelings, but without making people angry at you. And I don't have the answer. Luckily, so I don't have a formula to give you, and that's great because it's about you being alive and a human being and you finding out and that it's different with different people, with different groups. You don't do it all the time. And when you say your tap community, do you mean, what is your tap community?
New York City. But I'm connected with the international tap community. I mean, really, like all over the world. I work with an organization called the American Tap Dance Foundation.
Right.
So I know many dozens and dozens of professional tap dancers, black and white, of all generations.
Right, as far as I know, the tap community is quite diverse.
It is extremely diverse.
Yeah.
It's extremely diverse.
Right.
And I'm studying our history, and I'm getting it on stage and writing about it. I just feel like it's a challenging conversation to have. I admire your work enormously because it starts the conversation.
Right, right. Well, just, you know, going back to Corinthia's question, you know, again, like that kind of issue coming up or repeating itself about appropriation, or is it going to stop or will it continue, and then how is it taken? All that we can hope for is that people like you, the people who are in this room, will actually feel somehow, not just feel, but be empowered to be able to have some coordinates and some ground to stand upon when you need to be there and be part of the conversation, part of the discourse. And again, of course, you know, I'm talking all of this about language. I must also, again, acknowledge the difference between language and practice. You know, we talk, and the whole thing about, well, you know, can you walk the talk the walk, or however it goes. But that, you know, there's one thing about theorizing, and it's great, though. I mean, we need to do this, because I don't feel that we have many places in our country where we can even have this kind of a conversation. You know, it doesn't come up very frequently. And obviously, it's on a lot of people's minds. I see it on your faces. You know, so I mean, the fact that we are talking, that's the beginning, but then the next thing is like walking the walk, and one of the ways you walk the walk, in my opinion, is that you gain knowledge. So that's about us talking, reading, experiencing, and there's two kinds of knowledge, intellectual knowledge and experiential knowledge, you know. But I think there's always going to be, and if we call it something other than appropriation, you know, maybe... Like, I'm trying to not use the word racism. And I said, well, you know, I'm talking to my husband all the time. And so I said something like, well, maybe call it bigotry, you know. And Helmut said, oh, that sounds much worse, you know. So, you know, but what kinds, you know, and then, of course, like maybe ethnocentrism. And then, you know, others will say, well, why are you looking for euphemisms for this, you know. So, I mean, there are all of those struggles, you know. But in a sense, then, you know, that's the vitality of life. I mean, that's like kind of the Buddhist part of it, you know, that it's not finished. It's not done for you. And you're doing, and your present-mindedness, your awareness of being in the present with, that I'm, my conversation with you at this moment might be very different than how I would need to address it with Jenna, you know, whatever, you know. Okay. Yes. I'm good. What's your name?
I'm Megan.
Megan, hi.
Hi. Okay, I'm a double major in theater and sociology. Mm-hmm. And for my advanced directing class today, we had to read an interview with the highly famed director, Roy Richard.
Oh.
Who was the first director to direct Lady Hand's various compromises with his son.
Right.
And, in the interview, he was asked, "Is you were political?" And he responded, "I do consider myself political. Being born a black person in a white society, you are immediately political, whether you want to be." Even the denial that is political certainly has affected what I've chosen to do and not to do, and in many respects, I've chosen to do it. I don't feel that I've had to repress my political feelings, but when I express them, I'm liable to get hit for them. I've been denied work for political reasons, but I've always found a way to say what I want to say. And I found that statement very compelling, and it's definitely something that stuck with me over the last few hours of my day.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you could respond to that statement. It's true that being more a black person in society automatically makes you political.
I would take issue with Lloyd Richards because I think everybody is political, you know, and whether you know it or not, just like what I'm saying about, I think everybody is black, whether you know it or not. And I don't even mean just in terms of the culture in our country, I also mean in blood, okay? So there are things that exist whether we know it or not. I also, it's so interesting, in this movie, Beyond the Mainstream, there's some wonderful dance movies that can really start telling you something about the culture. Beyond the Mainstream, I feel, is one of them because it really hits the moment of when postmodern dance becomes postmodern dance. And at one point you see Steve Paxton doing contact and improvising with either Nancy Smith or Lisa Nelson. And they have a voiceover, and he says, "My work is very easy, cool, apolitical." And it was like, are you kidding? You know? It's like, you are in this political moment when you are making this big break from Martha Graham and Paul Taylor and all kinds of modern dance, and you are doing, even though you're doing it in dance, it's very political, you know? So I feel that, some real cliche, but man is a political animal or whatever. So I would say, Megan, for us all. And of course, now that doesn't mean some big generalization. What Lloyd Richards says, of course, for a person of African American lineage, there's a very particular politic. You know, for each of us, we have a particular politic. You know, I'm thinking, I want to sign some books. Do we have just, if there's a, is there a burning question that somebody wants to ask? Or if there is not a burning question, then that's okay too. Andrew, is it burning?
It's more going off of this discussion versus discussion earlier today.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Earlier today, we were talking about the idea of referencing, and you have focused heavily in this discussion about appropriation. What do you think the distinction is between like the idea of referencing and appropriation, and then even as it goes into the idea of like homage?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Say that again.
Sorry. How do you like? What do you think the real distinction is between, like, I guess, the postmodern idea of referencing versus what you call appropriation and clear idea behind appropriation?
Again, I wouldn't want to say that there are such clear divisions. I mean, if you're talking about Bob Dylan referencing a whole bunch of songs when he's ironically making this record, Love and Theft, that then is not appropriation because he's doing it as a reference, a conscious, you know, sarcastic, what have you. But 20 years from now, when somebody goes back and looks at it without the whole frame of reference, it might be read and deconstructed in a different way. I don't know that there's always clear delineations between, and I've said this now to every group that I think I spoke to here, the fact that, you know, artists don't like to give their sources, you know. And in the first chapter of Digging the Africanist Presence, I quote Deborah Jowett when she talks about some dancer in a review, and she says she's doing a Trisha Brownism. And she says something about, it's in the air, willy-nilly, people are doing Trisha Brownisms, you know. So, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, and none of my books, by the way, are Jacques, you know. So it's not like, I wouldn't want to, a lot of stuff is, as we know, I think we talked about this afternoon, is picked up unconsciously, you know. So I don't know that the lines of one, you know, appropriation or referencing, and many people are referencing and not doing it as a sarcastic statement on something. So, or maybe they are doing it as an homage, and I don't know if that means then that you have to do a program note or a CD note in order to make that clear. So I'm not really clear.
Just like to thank you, just once again. Can we all just give Brenda Dix Scott?
Thank you. I will sit here.
And I'd just like to remind everyone about the book signing right over here. You can just
if you have
a book right over here.
You know, I will sign it with my purple pen.
Have a great evening, and thank you for coming.